Welcome to the Family Express podcast, where our destination is resilient and connected families. Come aboard with your hosts, marriage and family therapists, Catherine DeBruin and Rhonda Evans, to explore the world of emotionally focused family therapy, a model developed by Sue Johnson and colleagues. Together with our guest speakers, our travels will map the EFFT landscape, highlighting lessons learned, shared fears, and the passion and curiosity that bonds our community.
Welcome back for another episode of the Family Express podcast with Catherine and Rhonda. Our guest today is Penda Galakonde, a licensed counselor in Uganda and a current graduate student here in the U.S. We will be speaking about a constellation of themes around loss, grief, connection, and maintaining connection through a fascinating topic called genetic mirrors. As we sit with Penda talking about these themes, we of course can't help but remember significant people we have lost in our lives, including our recent loss of Sue Johnson, founder of EFT. Penda, thank you for being here. Welcome.
Thank you, Rhonda. Glad to be here.
So, Penda, you have experienced a lot of loss in your life. I believe you lost your parents at a really young age.
Yeah, that's just correct, Catherine. I lost my dad when I was 3.5 and my mom when I was 6.
It's hard to imagine how that even was for you as such a young girl.
Oh, it was devastating. My dad's death, actually, I really wasn't fully aware of what happened. I'm told I played in the sand beside his grave, and totally oblivious of what was going on. But I'm sure my body registered something. But for my mom, I was 6 years old. I was fully aware and I froze. I was devastated. She was my best friend. And yeah, that just about killed me.
It sounded like they were such amazing parents, and it was just a massive, massive loss for you. And I know this is like many decades later, but I'm curious, do you still feel connected to them, you know, being so young and having those really early memories? Like, have you been able to hold on to them in some way?
Yeah. Strange thing is because, well, my parents' deaths also had a lot of silence. There was a loud silence after each of their deaths. And to this day, we're still discovering pieces about their deaths. My father, like I said, he was poisoned in Nigeria. He was murdered. And it was at an event that was, you know, it was a global event. He was heading a festival of African artists or Black art. And people came from all over the world, Brazil, you know, different parts of South America and Africa and the Caribbeans. And somebody wanted that position. But also the plays that were being shown sometimes were critical of existing governments. So we're not sure who killed him. And recently somebody started to investigate his death and the deaths of three others that happened around the same time, three other artists. And they're formulating a different theory of what actually happened. And it was very dangerous in those days, Amin's days in the 70s in Uganda, to be involved politically. And so there was a huge silence. So in a way, you can say I lost touch with who my father was. And maybe I don't have as much memory about my father as I do my mother, partly because of this silence that just shrouded his death. It was a great tragedy. It was a national tragedy, but at the same time, it was too complicated, too dangerous.
Gosh, Penda, that really touches me as you talk about the the loud silence. And of course, for it not to be safe to talk about or to get all the details, the information about what happened, it's so much harder, I think, to process something if you can't understand it and you don't have information, not to mention the young age that you were. And yet somehow you still feel very connected to your folks. And you had mentioned a concept called, was it genetic mirroring? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. So to get to the genetic mirroring, I have to tell you a little bit about my mom and that side of things, because that played out slightly differently. So she, like I said, died 3 years after my dad, and I was much older. It had a close relationship. I can remember things that we did together, places we lived and things we did. And when she died, I was just at that age where the relatives were not sure, do I understand what's going on? Do I not? All I know is that I froze. It was too much for me. It was too much to bear that I froze. I wasn't crying. I wasn't, I was just silent. I used to be very active, child, but I sat in a corner with my coloring book and I colored my pictures. And I had some grown-ups saying, she's not even crying. And I think to them it meant, I am not aware, I do not know what's going on, or I don't care, or I'm not affected. They misinterpreted what was going on. And I found that attitude then just was passed around, because it came, the discussion then came up. There are three children that my mother, Elvani Anamkwaya Zidimo, has left. What do we do? And at that time, a lot of my immediate family could not take in three children. It was just huge, financially, I think, for any of those immediate family. There was a distant relative who could afford to take three children, and his mother insisted that he didn't want us to, the three of us to be separated. So the other option would have been that one child goes to a different, like each one of us goes to a different family. But this elder matriarch said, I don't want those children to be separated. And in Uganda, elders have like a very special position. If they can say something and it's not questioned, and it was a good idea anyways. So it just turned out nobody was willing. And this distant relative, he said, yeah, I will take them for 6 months as you figure out what to do. And so the three of us were then taken to a distant relative. When I say distant relative, to this day, I don't know the exact bloodline, but I'm told that there is one and we do have some similar names. But this meant that we were not with either my mother's sister or my mother's brother or my father's brother or my father's sisters. We were with family that could take the three of us, that knew of us, that had a relationship with our parents, that could give us the life that we were used to. We'd been brought up in the city and all that, and a lot of my father's relatives lived in a very rural area without basic amenities. There's no electricity or running water and that type of thing, and I think they wanted to. And I'm making some of this up because I wasn't there, but I can put myself in their shoes and imagine that what they were thinking. So So we go to this family, and it was very different in that, we didn't know how long we were staying. We didn't know what our rights were, what was going to happen. I mean, just total disorientation that I think I want us to be aware of even as we speak about adoption for children. What, you know, what goes on in the level of disorientation. I don't know if I'm communicating that. Does that, I don't want to overlabor the point either.
No, Pendo, I think it's great. And I think it's such an important point to make about how disorienting it can be to go from one abrupt living situation to another one, and maybe even without a good orientation, right? Like, who is this person? How do I know this person? Why am I here? And I think you're making a great point about how disorienting that is.
Also, how long am I going to be here? How long? What are they going to look after me? What areas do I go to them for? What areas do I go to another person for? All that was just sort of swirling around, not clear. Mm-hmm. And that was the background of maybe she doesn't know what's happened. If we talk about her mother, she may be hurt. And if we keep silent, she might forget, and then she will be fine. So I think they chose to be silent. They chose to not talk about my mother. So it's like, I'm devastated. I have no words to express. I'm frozen. I've lost all vocabulary. You know, I just cannot talk about what's happened. And the people around me also go silent about this, and we try to do life. I cannot tell you how traumatic that was, in addition to what had already happened. Mm-hmm. So I think that is the beginning of loss of connection. It's a loss of processing. I believe I lost touch with parts of myself in that moment, because there wasn't the opportunity to process, to grieve healthily, and to be reassured, because we were not talking about this. We were denying that anything wrong had happened. Mm. In addition, if people visited, and all this really was done with the best of intentions. But my relatives would offer, if someone visited and asked, oh, I don't recognize this child, they'd say, oh, that's the one, you know, that comes after this one. So it just sort of covered up who I really was and what my story was. And this was all to just not hurt my feelings, not to make me feel like the orphan. But it also meant, once again, we couldn't mourn, we couldn't get comfort, I couldn't do any of those things. So it was much later that during my journey of mental health, now learning about mental health and healing myself, that I started to read about the adopted child and how they may lose memory, you know, from so much denial, and how important it is to grow up around your genetic mirror. Several times during the day, in any family's life, you will be told how, oh, you laugh like your grandmother. Look at those hands. Look at those hands, you know. Or somebody will, you look up it and see that you look like your mother, or you walk like your father. You know, comments are made, pictures that are around the family home will remind somebody of where they belong and where they come from. And those are the genetic mirrors. So having grown up very far from my genetic mirrors just meant that I wasn't getting that validation on a day-to-day basis of this is who I am and this is where I came from. So that's how that conversation, I think, came up in our last interview.
Wow. That, oh my gosh, I just got so many thoughts and feelings inside, Pendo, as you say all that. It makes so much sense that there is, in essence, I think what you're describing is two losses, right? Two, and not meant to quantify it, but the first loss of your parent, and then the second loss of your connection to them that can only really at that age be passed down to you by the adults sharing it and passing down that information at the age of six. And so I just think about the hardship of the silence and what we lose because of that silence. And it makes me just think about little six-year-old Pendo, just devastated, just earth-shaking loss. And what do you do with it? Where do you put it? Where does it go? And then losing that genetic mirroring opportunities because of the silence. I just kind of lean into that right now with you.
Yeah, that's how you've said it exactly right, that it was two losses. The first loss of the parent, but then the second of that connection that could have been built and nurtured. So for some years, there wasn't a lot of that. There was a lot of silence. I did catch my sister crying once, and I asked her what it was. And I think it was one of these Bob Marley songs on radio. Mama, look at the mountain, and Papa, look at the stars, or something like that. And this just reminded her of our parents. And so I got little glimpses like that. And the pain spilling, and she cried, I didn't, but I was very sad and reminded of my sadness in that moment with her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just thinking about, or actually not just thinking, I'm more feeling into that incredible sadness and the loss. And I think I'm curious about, I mean, it's one thing to read about genetic mirroring, right, Pendo? It's one thing to read about it and learn about it. Maybe you're in school. But I think I'm wondering about your personal experiences with genetic mirroring being offered to you. And I think I'm wondering if besides those glimpses, if you got those experiences and those stories of people saying, you remind me of your mother, did that eventually come around?
Oh, yes, it did eventually. So with time, I had a grandmother that used to visit every once in a while, and an aunt and uncle who made the occasional contact. But the person that made the biggest difference is my mother's friend. She is a British woman that had worked with my mother in Uganda. She lived there, and they'd been good friends. And she'd moved back to the UK, but came to visit Uganda regularly. And she stayed with this family where I stayed. And she made it a point to bring me books, read to me, tell me a lot about my parents and my parents' contemporaries. My parents were deep, deep, deep in the arts, you know, and a lot of their friends were writers and poets and actors and that type of thing. And a lot of the African writers of that time, you know, the Ngugi wa Thiong'os, the Wallace Soyinkas, the, you know, those people would have been lost to me, really. We were in a totally different world. My adoptive family was more into business. They were into the auto industry, and that was the bigger part of their lives rather than, it was a totally different, it was a, there were two different worlds, so to speak. So she would bring me books by African writers and children's books and sit me on a stool and read to me and tell me all these things that I had no clue what she was talking about. And she would just go on about her name and be looking up at her and sharing this and just wondering why she's telling me all these things. And I just initially would, that was another disorientation, really. Like, what is she about? Who is Tabanoli? Why should I care? But slowly, I started to feel connected to these stories. And as I got more independence and, you know, she started, you know, and I had a car, she'd take me to visit my mom's friends and we'd have lunch with this person and my mom's sisters and we'd go, you know, for an afternoon visit and places that my parents went. And she is the one who, I think, the first time told me, we were at a party at one of my uncle's houses, my mom's brother, and she was sitting with my uncle right across from me. And she stopped and they were staring at me. And she said, oh my goodness, doesn't she look exactly like Van? And this is the first time that I became aware of how much I look like my mother. No one before that had ever mentioned anything. I wasn't surrounded by pictures of her. I didn't have anything in my surrounding that would help me know what my mother looked like. I, for sure, I'd seen pictures before, but I couldn't tell that, who did I look like? And to this day, it's actually very hard for me to judge resemblance. But yeah, so she was the first one to tell me that. And then sometime later, I was walking on the streets and met this elderly lady, and she almost dropped her stuff, you know. She looked at me like she'd seen a ghost. And she said, oh my goodness, you look like Van. And we've just, you know, they'd had a recent, I think, class reunion of contemporaries. And so coming upon me on the streets, and this started to make me think, oh, I look like someone, you know, that she may not be here, but I look like her. And this... Yeah, so Pat Howard, anyway, is the one who helped me to fill in those gaps of, you did this. And then she is the one who told me, there's a time that I was going to renew my driver's license. And the doctor said, well, you have a little bit of a weak eye and your right eye is weak. And I said, I don't want glasses. Give me some exercises. And she said, your mother said exactly the same thing. Wow. They told her that. Yeah. So I'm just thinking, well, yeah, genetics is strong. But yeah, and it does make an impact when you grow up without that feedback of you are like this person.
Yeah, Pendo, this is very, very touching. Like, just you telling the story of what you've been through in your life, but you're really helping us understand this concept of genetic mirroring. It's coming alive for me, and I'm finding myself having all kinds of flashbacks to, you know, people saying things to me about, you look like so-and-so, or you like this activity just like so-and-so. And this, you know, some of us get so many of that comments, but I've never really understood just how deeply that can impact how we feel and who we are, and how that's can become a fundamental building block to our identity. And as you started getting just glimpses of that, like those, just, it seems like those were just so special and memorable. And your takeaway was like, I am like someone, you know, like someone's telling me where I belong in this family and who I'm like because of some of that genetic code.
Yeah, I think that maybe even as we talk about attachment, that the way we survive in the world is when we are attached to some people, you know, maybe our parents, for example. A child comes into the world and they know these are my parents. And there's a certain safety and security in knowing that biologically you come from these people, and even your siblings, and then your extended family and all that. It's an assurance that you will not be left alone. You know, there's reason. So I think that assurance for me had been lost or badly shaken when there wasn't any talk of, you know, biologically where I come from. Like, okay, I know I have my adoptive family, but that was, like I said, undefined. How long am I here for? Who are they to me? How, you know, what's the arrangement? How much can I lean on this arrangement? But then being told you came from your mother and you look like your mother, and it was really exciting to discover that.
That's amazing how you're saying that sense of attachment is built and that experience of belonging by just looking at our surroundings and seeing how we fit in because we look similar to people or we have similar interests or characteristics. And what a big part of our implicit experience that is growing up, right? For families that maybe don't openly talk about that. And yet when that's not there, again, like what a silence that is, what an emptiness exists if words aren't put to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I can think of so many families where maybe children are adopted or they're being fostered or they move from home to home, and these losses that cannot even be pinpointed. Just the familiarity, the familiarness of people that have similar features to you or interests or tastes. The other day I was visiting my sister and a cousin was with us, and we didn't need to explain that the tea kettle needed to be hot all the time. We just drink tea. That's what we do. And I find that it was such a relief. We were like, oh, it's so good to be with people that just have exactly the same need to have tea all the time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think what strikes me about that is that we all need that. And when you're younger, you absolutely need that and absorb that. And again, it's those building blocks to our identity. And yet as kids, we don't know that we need this. And it's hard to put words to it. It's hard to ask for it, right? You know, maybe there was a part of you that was just dying to know, like, tell me more about my parents. Tell me stories. Who are they? And yet, when we're young, like going to those older generations and asking for that information, it's not easy to ask for emotionally, or we don't know to ask about it. And then I think, like, by the time we grow up and realize that these family stories and the history is important, sometimes those people have passed on. But you had some very wise people in your circle, and your parents were surrounded by such a beautiful community and people, and thank goodness for some of their wisdom to, you know, keep the siblings together and then to come in and help you get connected to some of your ancestrage.
Absolutely. I mean, that family just was amazing for taking all three of us in. And then Pat Howard, I don't know how she had just the foresight that I will visit regularly. I will tell these children about, you know, their parents' world. And not only that, she wrote a book about my mother, about my parents, but really the story centered on my mother. And that was just a gift that is indescribable, because I'm able to go back and now read, just read about her and understand who she was and how she was. And you're right. I did have the urge to say, tell me about my mother, but I didn't know who to ask. And it was great that she volunteered. So she became that person that I knew I could ask. But the visits were like once a year. I'd have to wait for.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, the way I like to think about it is that that was your mom and dad's impact on the world. And that's part of them, you know, loving you through the community, right? She wouldn't have done that unless your parents meant a lot to her. And so maybe that's them taking care of you in some way.
Yes, yes. It's amazing that I still feel cared for by my parents, even when they died, what, 40-some years ago. Wow. My dad, when I went to university, I was filling those application forms and wrote my dad's name. And immediately they're like, what? You're a Zirimu?
Mm. You know,
and started to treat me. Always we get better treatment when like our parents' name is known. But then also some years back, one of the publishing houses in the U.S. asked for permission to reprint our mother's plays. And so every once in a while, you get a royalty check. It's not a lot of money, but this is my mother still providing.
Oh,
so many years later.
Her legacy, right. For sure. Pendo, I can't help but think about being in the therapy room with families and how often in those first sessions, it's easy for me to say to families, well, tell me about your family and who's like this and who's like that. But having spoken to you now, the depth of my questions is going to be different. And I think I want to say to people, who looks like who? You know, who have we lost in this family? What do you remember about them? Who shares similar mannerisms? Who looks different? Who feels like they don't look like anybody? And what's that like for you? And yeah, it just makes me want to be a lot more explicit around genetic mirroring and ask these questions and get curious.
Yeah. And I'm thinking also about children that sometimes are left out when there's a death in the family. We don't always explain it to children or give them a chance to say goodbye. I think they need to be helped to grieve, to mourn, to write pictures or letters and retain connection with other members of the family. I think that many times the adults keep the information to themselves, but that it's important, the attachment and knowing that we're all connected, and they may be young, but they need to have their own way to be let in, that someone's either died or dying, and to, you know, their connections, those connections are important no matter the age of the child.
Absolutely. We're going through that right now with my son, and we had a sudden death in the family, and we've made a point to tell him, you know, this toy is from your Auntie Naya who just died. This picture, this is your Auntie Naya. You're sitting with her. You were opening a Christmas gift, and she was very generous, and she had a collection of glass bluebirds. There was like 20 of them, these little glass bluebirds, and only one of them was red. My son got to choose which of the birds he wanted to remember his Auntie Naya by. And he said, I want the red one, because when I think of Auntie Naya, I think of red. Mm-hmm. Those types of conversations are, I think I love the concrete nature. Like, this is the toy, this is the bird, this is the photo, this is who she was, this is how you were connected to her. You know, those interactions, he's had very few interactions with her, but we have these concrete things around the house. They're not hidden away. They're not stored up. They're in his room if he wants them to be. And that's what we've done to help him understand she was here and now she's not, and she loved you. And this is a concrete way to remember her by.
Oh, Rhonda, as you said that, I just felt tears just coming into my eyes. That is so beautiful. Mm-hmm. So beautiful. So concrete.
Yeah.
So you were loved.
Yeah.
You were loved. Yeah.
You know, Pendo, I love the way you're linking this back to attachment and to this is how we experience connection. Some of it's really implicit. I just can feel like I belong for all these reasons. And then also that sense of belonging is so important and foundational. And if we look at children who end up struggling in life, even honestly, you know, the suicide rates are so high right now. But one of the biggest risk factors in suicide is I don't belong anywhere. Mm-hmm. Do I have a sense of knowing myself? Do I belong anywhere? Mm-hmm. And so here you are talking about something again that can be so implicit in our family systems, but that is so important in terms of connection, building a sense of belonging, building a sense of identity that becomes the building blocks for emotional health and relational health throughout life. So thank you so much for helping me understand this and then also being able to see like how little comments like Rhonda's making to her son is a way to build emotional health in a moment like that with the kiddo.
Yeah, and thank you for expounding it. I like how you, in the previous comment, where you said that when you're interviewing families, you'll now be seeing who is like, who feels like an outsider. Because we're assuming, the way I was saying it, it was like, a parent has to have died or something. But you're right that even in the nucleus family, one child may feel like they're totally different from the rest and that they don't have as much connection. And this is a risk factor. You're right.
Wow. What a good point, huh? What a good point about how these types of conversations, in essence, breaking the silence, is a building block to connection, to emotional health, and takes the implicit to the explicit in our work with families. I just learned so much through every one of these conversations. It's always so enlightening. And I'm just so grateful to our guests like you, Pendo, for the way you've experienced things, you know, your worldview, your experiences, and how we can, what's the word? Only words coming to mind, like make use of, but that doesn't quite seem right, but how we can learn from that and how we can apply that in our work with families. I'm just so grateful.
Yeah, Pendo, thank you for your generosity of spirit in sharing the story with us. And it is not lost on me just how much you've probably had to work on yourself to be able to get to a place like this where you have, you know, rebuilt and read that identity and found those connections. And you had to really do a lot of that later, I'm sure. So I just like, I'm inspired by who you are today. And thank you so much for sharing this big part of yourself with us.
Thank you, Catherine. And thank you also for your generosity and just connecting me with EFT World. It's been a big, big help, I think, to find a body of people that really understand the value of attachment. And it's been very, very helpful for me. Yeah. Thank you both for this platform, too.
Absolutely. Thank you, Pendo. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
That's it for today, folks. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you again for our next journey.